Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. This Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on a shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You could use a shortwave radio with the schedule of English language broadcast, but it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from France 24, NHK World Radio Japan, and Radio Havana Cuba. We will begin with France 24, starting with 3 press reviews. First, how did the press cover the Ukrainian drone attacks on bombers deep into Russian territory? Then a variety of press on the Israeli announcement on expanding settlements in the West Bank. And then press from The Guardian on the Red Crescent report as to what happened to those 15 medics in Palestine who were murdered then buried in March. The U.S. alone vetoed a U.N. resolution calling for a ceasefire and humanitarian access in Gaza. Activists are on a flotilla bringing aid to Gaza following the drone attack last month on an aid vessel preparing to leave for Gaza from Malta. Then press reviews from the day of the South Korean snap presidential elections, giving some background on the importance of the vote following much turmoil and threats of martial law. France 24.
Let's move to Ukraine now. After that huge attack on Russia's military aviation, Kyiv, we're just getting into new figures coming into us, actually. So they've destroyed 13 planes and damaged many others as well, up to 40, striking thousands of kilometers from its borders.
That's right. The Financial Times here calls it a bold drone strike deep inside Russian territory. The article says that the Ukrainian intelligence service said that they've been preparing the operation for over a year. An opinion piece here from the Washington Post says that Ukraine just rewrote the rules of war. It adds that Ukrainians revealed a vulnerability and asks if they can sneak in drones like this to close to major air bases in Russia. What prevents China, for example, from doing so in the US, for example? It adds that this shows the need of massive investment in counter-drone systems. And moving to Ukrainian Daily, the Kyiv Post here, that says that US President Donald Trump wasn't given a heads up about the attack. The attack was 100% purely Ukrainian, and the US didn't have anything to do with it.
Any reaction at all from the Russian side of it? Huh?
Yes, from a Radio Free Europe that interviewed Russians in Siberia who, quote, appeared to be shaken, according to the newspaper. Now the war has reached us too.
Israel has announced that it's expanding its settlements in the West Bank. Alitza, tell us how the papers are reacting.
That's right, Vedika. This is one of the biggest expansions in decades. The American TV CBS News says that the announcement has sparked global criticism. The article here reminds that the majority of the international community views settlements as illegal and as the main obstacle to resolving the conflict between Palestine and Israel. We have here the French left-wing Libération paper that says that Israel is, quote, sprinting to annex Palestinian territories. The paper also writes that the new plan wants to, quote, dismember what's left of Palestine. Let's take a look now at British daily The Independent that has some reactions from the UK that has also condemned the move. It cites a tweet by Hamish Falconer. He is Britain's Middle East minister, who said that the settlements are, quote, a deliberate obstacle to Palestinian statehood. That's what he wrote. And he also said that they further imperil the two-state solution.
Now, Ilitsa, Israel often says that settlements also exist for security reasons. Is there anything in the papers about that?
That's right, Vedika. I actually want to draw your attention to this article in Israeli left-wing paper Haaretz. The article here reads, "Why the West Bank bulletproof vest theory is not only wrong, but also dangerous." So that theory is, of course, the idea that settlements serve as a barrier against terror attacks. The paper says that this is simply not true and dives deep into examples, like historical examples, of why it didn't work, concluding that, quote, "the goal of the settlement enterprise isn't security, but to create pretext for the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians."
Starting with an exclusive report by the Palestinian Red Crescent's account about what happened to those 15 medics killed by Israeli forces last September.
Yeah, that's right. Last March, rather, Stuart. It's an exclusive from The Guardian. Today you have it here. The Guardian relaying this testimony that was given to the Palestinian Red Crescent Society by Asad al-Nasasra. Now, he's one of two survivors from that March 23rd attack when 15 of his first responder colleagues were slaughtered by Israeli Defense Forces. They had been sent in to recover the bodies of two paramedics who had died in an earlier attack when their ambulances were ambushed. Now, Nasasra detailed what happened that day to the PRCS, telling them that he heard Israeli troops shooting his colleagues while some of them were clinging to life. Their bodies were later found in a mass grave with injuries indicating that some had died through blows to the back of their skull. Nasasra himself was detained and then tortured by Israeli forces for 37 days, including being subjected to solitary confinement, starvation, and having loud music played for long periods of time. Earlier this week, 27 Palestinians were killed in a series of shootings near food delivery sites. It's prompted a sharp rebuke from British Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer. The Telegraph today reporting that at the House of Commons on Wednesday, he described Israel's recent action in Gaza as, quote, appalling, reiterated calls for a ceasefire. He also said that he wouldn't rule out imposing sanctions on Israel. You'll remember, of course, the UK, Canada and France released a joint statement last month, Stuart, criticizing Israel for preventing aid from entering Gaza.
The United States vetoed a resolution calling for a ceasefire and humanitarian access to Gaza on Wednesday. The other 14 members of the Security Council voted in favour of the text. Algeria's ambassador to the UN, Amar Benjama, said that the vote showed the collective will of the entire world and sent a message to the Palestinians: you are not alone. Well, the US veto came as no surprise here. Washington's UN envoy Dorothy Shea said that the United States couldn't support the resolution because it fails to condemn Hamas. The US also vetoed a resolution on Gaza back in November under the Biden administration because the ceasefire demand wasn't directly linked to the unconditional release of all hostages. This resolution called for the release of the hostages held by Hamas, but it didn't make the release a precondition for a ceasefire. The text demanded an immediate, unconditional and permanent ceasefire in Gaza, respected by all parties. It also described the humanitarian situation there as catastrophic and demanded the lifting of restrictions on the entry of aid into Gaza. Civilians must not starve, Slovenian's ambassador said during this meeting. Well, the vote comes amidst controversy over the use of private US military contractors to deliver aid in Gaza, usurping the role of the UN. Civilians have been shot dead at the aid hub set up by the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, a private group backed by Israel. Israel argues that the system is necessary to prevent Hamas from stealing the aid, but the United Nations has rejected the new system, saying that Israel is using aid as a weapon.
Everyone, this is a new alert. We can clearly see a drone right now to our left.
In the dark of the early hours on Tuesday, in the Mediterranean Sea, activists Tiago Avila and Greta Thunberg were on alert. Spotting a drone overhead, they sent out a distress signal.
Now we count on all of you to share what's going on here and to please let the world know that we are 80 kilometers from Greece.
along with 10 other activists, Avila and Thunberg set sail from Sicily on the 1st of June aboard the humanitarian vessel Madeleine, part of the Freedom Flotilla Coalition. Its destination, Gaza. The crew attempting to break the siege imposed by Israel. The boat carrying a modest humanitarian cargo is at risk of being attacked or intercepted, as another Freedom Flotilla vessel was last month.
No matter how dangerous this mission is, it is nowhere near as dangerous as the silence of the entire world in the face of a live-stream genocide.
The Israeli military says it's ready to protect the citizens of Israel on all fronts.
The Navy operates day and night to protect Israel's maritime space. For this case as well, we are prepared. We have gained experience in recent years and we will act accordingly.
That experience includes its response to the Gaza Freedom Flotilla 15 years ago. Israel attacked aid-carrying ships while they were in international waters en route for Gaza, killing 9 humanitarian volunteers. The Madeleine is equipped with a tracker, its location constantly broadcast online. The crew members are asking the world to keep a steady eye on the vessel's location to help, they say, deter violence and hold potential aggressors accountable for their actions.
The South Korean elections, the press they're reacting as the elections get underway, Dipti.
Yeah, it's dominating the South Korean press, naturally. As you can imagine, Stuart, this Tuesday, Korean voters heading to the polls for those snap presidential elections after months of political turmoil that came after the ouster of former President Yoon Suk-yeol. Now, these are the faces of the two leading candidates are on the front of the Korea Times here. You have Lee Jae-myung from the Liberal Democratic Party and the conservative leader Kim Moon-soo here on the right, the Korean paper, which is a centrist paper. Also underlining, as you see there on the front page, an interesting fact that the new leader will be taking office without the customary 60-day transition period. The last time this happened was back in 2017 when Moon Jae-in won the election and took office one day after winning. It obviously once again raises concerns about the government's readiness to manage state affairs, but nonetheless, this is what will happen right after this election. Koreans will no doubt be hoping for stability in the country politically and economically because, of course, Donald Trump's tariff wars have hit the South Korean economy hard. It's perhaps why the Korea Herald today calls it a D-Day showdown on its front page.
Yeah, the editorials have quite a lot to say as well, don't they, Dipti?
Yeah, absolutely. And you can really grasp how the gravity of this election really through the editorials today. This is from the Korea Times there, which says that Korea's future hinges on this election. The paper really encouraged by the high level of early voting, despite rather high levels of voter apathy and frustration. But it reminds us nonetheless that that elections are not a choice between good and bad, but rather the lesser of two evils. This is from the Korea Joongang Daily. This is a conservative paper in the country there, which says that the presidential election must bring a new start for Korea. The paper actually likening this election to a recent Korean box office hit called Yadang, The Snitch, a film which examines political and institutional corruption. This paper really encouraging voters to scrutinize candidates carefully, saying, I quote, loyalty, sentiment and empty promises should not sway votes. And finally, you have the Hankyore, which is a very progressive paper in Korea, which says that Tuesday's election opens a new chapter in Korean democracy. It's time for voters to shine, it says. And the paper calls it a pivotal moment for Korean society as well.
Those press reviews and reports were from France 24. France 24 may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English, and most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. Next, NHK World Radio Japan. The South Korean election resulted in a victory for Lee Jae-myung, the liberal candidate who formerly led the opposition party. He says he will pursue the peaceful reunification of the Koreas, promote individual freedom and public welfare. Lee was a former human rights lawyer and faces ongoing criminal trials. There's a huge plan to build a new 800-mile-long gas pipeline in Alaska that would create liquid natural gas for sale to Asian countries. Alaska hopes to begin building the pipeline next year. The British government unveiled a new defense strategy for the next decade, including spending $20 billion to develop nuclear warheads. NHK Japan.
Lee Jae-myung of South Korea's Democratic Party was sworn in as president Wednesday. He said he'll work to bridge the country's divide.
이번 대선에서 누구를 지지했든
No matter who you supported in this election, I will be a president for all the people. It is a president's role to foster greater unity.
The 21st president also said he'll honor the Constitution, protect the country, and pursue the peaceful unification of the peninsula. He also promised to promote individual freedom and public welfare. He said he also wants to strengthen national culture.
Through practical diplomacy, the major shifts in the world economy and global security can be opportunities for our national interests. Based on our solid alliance with the United States, we will strengthen cooperation with the U.S. and Japan and approach relations with neighboring countries with our interests and practicality in mind.
He already spoke with the chairman of South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff. He was briefed on North Korea's recent military activities. He later said he'll make sure the country is prepared for Pyongyang's nuclear and military provocations. He said he'll pursue deterrence based on the South Korea-U.S. military alliance. But he also suggested he was also open to discussions with the North. He said he'll open channels of communication and work towards peace through dialogue. Let's take a look at Lee Jae-myung's political career and what he pledged during the election campaign.
Lee is the 60-year-old former leader of South Korea's Democratic Party. This marked his second run for president after he narrowly lost to Yoon Suk-yeol in 2022. Following that defeat, Lee became leader and tightened his grip over the Democratic Party, consolidating support and quelling internal dissent. A former human rights lawyer, Lee got his start in politics as mayor of Seongnam City and then became governor of Gyeonggi Province. There, he built a reputation both for his administrative ability and his outspoken remarks, which helped propel him to national prominence. He has been critical of Japan in the past, even calling it an enemy country while he was mayor of Seongnam. In the primary to choose the Democratic Party's candidate, Lee won in a landslide with nearly 90% of the vote. Polls since then have consistently placed him as the election frontrunner. However, he faces multiple ongoing criminal trials, including an indictment for allegedly violating the Public Official Election Act. He is accused of making false claims about an urban development project during the previous presidential campaign. On the diplomatic front, Lee has adopted a softer tone. During the election campaign, he emphasized the importance of cooperating with Japan and the U.S. and said he has a very good feeling towards the Japanese people.
Officials from Japan and other Asian nations have attended a government briefing in Alaska on a planned liquefied natural gas project in the region. The Trump administration is urging the countries to invest in the venture as a means to reduce their trade surpluses with the U.S. The $44 billion project aims to pump natural gas from Prudhoe Bay in northern Alaska to the southern part of the state through a 1,300-kilometer pipeline. It'll then be converted into LNG for export by ship to Asia. Representatives from South Korea and Taiwan also flew in for the briefing on Monday. Energy Secretary Chris Wright, Interior Secretary Doug Burgum, and Alaska Governor Mike Dunleavy were the senior officials attending for the U.S. Burgum stressed the importance of the project.
Energy is the foundation of our economy. It's the foundation of prosperity for our country. It's also the foundation of prosperity for our allies. And when we can have enough energy for ourselves and then sell energy to our friends and allies, they don't have to buy it from our adversaries.
Washington has indicated countries investing or buying the LNG could reduce their surpluses with the U.S. to help ease current trade conflicts. The state hopes to start construction of the Alaska LNG project in 2026 and begin production in 2031. But potential investors have raised concerns about cost overruns and the fate of the venture post the Trump administration. The British government has unveiled its defense strategy for the next decade. It says measures are needed to counter what it calls an immediate and pressing threat from Russia.
When we are being directly threatened by states with advanced military forces, the most effective way to deter them is to be ready.
The Starmer administration has been reviewing the country's defense strategy since taking office last year. It's investing £15 billion, about $20 billion, to develop nuclear warheads and will build up to 12 attack submarines. The government also wants to create a hybrid navy that combines warships, submarines, and autonomous vessels. And it plans to increase the number of full-time troops. Defense officials say Britain's goal of spending 3% of GDP on defense in the 2030s will be met if economic and fiscal conditions allow. Opposition parties have criticized the plans, saying it's unclear how they'll be financed.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan. On shortwave, they're heard at 10 p.m. at 13710 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. All the times I announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. NHK is available at most podcast sites, and by that I mean Apple Podcasts, Spotify, etc. They're everywhere. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this program, there's a link for online donations available at my website, outfarpress.com, or you could write directly to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many, many thanks to everyone who's ever helped keep this freely distributed show on the airwaves. Please help if you can. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please help support them as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. A senior Hamas official says that Special Envoy Steve Witkoff originally agreed to a Gaza ceasefire proposal, but was pressured by Israel to reject it. American economist Jeffrey Sachs says that the epoch of U.S. global dominance has ended, but the U.S. has not yet recognized it. Radio Havana, Cuba.
A senior Hamas official says that U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff initially agreed to a recent Gaza ceasefire proposal put forward by the Palestinian resistance movement, but then later yielded to demands from the occupying Israeli regime and rejected it. Witkoff fully agreed to the framework of a ceasefire agreement that Hamas had proposed, but yielded to Israeli demands, according to Mahmoud Mardawi. He stated that Hamas would not have moved forward with the proposal if Witkoff had raised any objections while the group was drafting the document. He pointed out that the Hamas proposal aimed for a permanent ceasefire, a comprehensive Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, unrestricted entry of aid, and guarantees of implementation of the ceasefire deal from the Trump administration. In return, Israel immediately rejected the demands, and Witkoff described them as unacceptable. Hamas maintains that 10 living Israeli captives and the bodies of 18 others who have been killed in Israeli airstrikes would be released in exchange for an agreed-upon number of Palestinian prisoners. The Israeli occupation wants to receive the captives on the first day of the truce without guarantees of implementation of the deal. We will not hand over 10 occupation captives without sufficient guarantees for a ceasefire. The senior Hamas official further argued that the Tel Aviv regime circumvented the ceasefire proposal agreed upon by the resistance group and the U.S. envoy in order to solve its internal political problems. Additionally, another senior Hamas official took a swipe at Israel over disagreeing with agreed-upon provisions and criticized a complete bias towards the other side that he said violates the fairness of mediation. American economist Jeffrey Sachs says that the epoch of Washington's global dominance has ended, but the United States has not recognized that so far. He said, in a multipolar world, there is a great power. The United States is a great power. China is a great power. India is a great power. Sachs, in an interview with TASS, published over the weekend, said, the question is, can we now live in peace in such an environment? Will the U.S. accept the fact that it cannot call the shots anymore? He added that Washington is still in the denial stage. He believes that the U.S. still believes it runs the show. And that is a dangerous misconception in the United States. Elsewhere in his remarks, Jeffrey Sachs referred to the Western sanctions against Russia following the war in Ukraine, arguing that they have only strengthened and enhanced Russia's economy instead of ruining it as it was expected by Western governments. The economist noted that while the sanctions did inflict some harm, they also led to positive outcomes. Russia's ties with China and India strengthened amid these challenges, and several industries that have relied on imports saw improvement due to the growth of domestic production. Obviously, the sanctions regime did not crush the Russian economy, despite all of the claims that the sanctions would have that effect. Jeffrey Sachs, the economist from the United States, said, the sanctions regime did not work. It didn't produce the results that the Western governments expected. It did not have enormous effects. In some ways, it really strengthened the Russian economy. The United States and its European allies have maintained tough sanctions on Moscow since 2014. The anti-Russia sanctions then intensified after Moscow launched its special military operation in eastern Ukraine in February 2022 to stop NATO's eastern encroachment on Russia. Russia now holds the record as the most sanctioned country globally, exceeding restrictions placed on Iran, Venezuela, and Cuba.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You have to look harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 29th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm still recuperating from a spinal injury, and I'm staying in a house connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.